The Friday Report with Lucy Morgan on Isle of Wight Radio.
Welcome back then. This is the Friday Report and we thought we'd start today, or I thought we'd start today, with that doom-laden prediction of what would happen when they started bringing 5p charge on a plastic bag. Now, Lee, I'm going to come to you first from the CAB here, because although, you know, you can look at this quite cynically and say, for goodness sake, how bad's it going to be? Actually, it is an extra cost on the cost of going to the shop if you go out prepared. For example, today I went in to get a single thing. I came out with an arm laden, stuff all over the place, like literally dropping stuff on the floor. And I thought, well, I'm not going to pay for my plastic bag because I can get to the car without dropping it. Transpired I couldn't. But, you know, the upshot is that you're going to the shops. Is it another sort of tax on people shopping?
I think it's twofold, really. I think it's not something new. I think sort of Bag for Lives have been around an awful long time. And I think, you know, most of us knew this was coming. It will have an impact on the poorest in society, because to a lot of people, 5p may not be a lot of money. However, to the poorest in society who've got nothing, 5p is a fortune. So people will find a way around it. I know some supermarkets have suddenly lost all their baskets because people are taking the stuff home in baskets. So I know things are happening around that, but I'm sure most people will get used to it and hopefully build that extra charge of the carrier bags, or buy Bags for Life and build that into their future budgets.
Is it a sort of necessary evil, do you think? You kind of have to do it in order to change people's mindsets, just get into that habit of taking a different bag with you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an environmentalist, but I think if you speak to people that spend a lot of time on the beach, and a lot of people that sort of look at nature, and you can see the impact of those particular plastic bags on beaches, and you can see them when people sort of look at wildlife and sort of rurally. So I do think they have an impact on our society. I think they are a thing that needs to be controlled in some way. And, you know, let's hope that this becomes normal after a few weeks of its initial kind of putting in place.
Nigel, have you been hampered by the lack of plastic bag yet? Juggling your Jaffa cakes out the supermarket?
I've always been terrible at taking my own bags to the supermarket. I'm always end up having to buy them. I think Lee's right. I mean, you know, the worry is the poorest people in society. We have to think about that. If this is an environmentally driven exercise, most of us get that. Most of us get that we need to find some solution to it. I suppose if it's not about major supermarkets making more and more money, then actually, why don't they say the 5p will go to the charity?
I mean, well, I think, do you know what? Really, I actually think it is going to charity.
Oh, is it? Well,
yeah. Now, I think the supermarkets themselves can name the charity that money goes to. But I think the way of monitoring that is slightly unclear at the moment. So it does go to charity.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's good to hear.
But is it enough? Because, you know, the other way of looking at it is, well, you know, for example, I would use my plastic bag to put in the bin, would be my bin liner. Now I'm going to have to theoretically go and buy a bin liner, which isn't going to be as biodegradable as the plastic bag that I got from the shop because of the laws on biodegradable bags and supermarkets. So is it the right way to do it, do we think? Stuart, I'll come to you.
I think at the end of the day, it probably is the right way to do it. I was quite sceptical at first when I heard this, because, like Nigel has just alluded to, I thought this is another money-making exercise for the big groups, the Morrisons, the Asdas, the Marks and Spencers, the Waitrose, and organisations like that. But when, as you've just said, Lucy, looking into it, the fact of the matter is that these organisations will be able to nominate their own charities. And I just look back at what's happened in Scotland and in Ireland, Northern Ireland especially, that the usage of plastic bags since the inception of the 5p charge has dropped quite colossally. I mean, absolutely by the million. So that in itself will have a knock-on effect, a knock-on effect of environmentally. That have a huge impact, a huge positive impact in the environment rather than the negative impact, as Lee said earlier, about wildlife being caught up in these things. There have even been cases of huge fish or huge mammals out to sea being beached and their stomachs being filled with things like plastic bags and plastic bottles and things thousands of miles away from land. So there has got to be a positive aspect to it, and I think we should applaud that.
All right, look, I don't want to dwell on the 5p on plastic bags because it hasn't bit. We haven't seen people marching through the street waving plastic bags in the way the papers might have had us believe at the start of the week. But if you've got your thoughts on this, and maybe you've fallen foul of this like I did this morning, and you had to juggle all your shopping to get it to the car, and no, I'm not spending that 5p, then let me know today. You can tweet at iWhite Radio, hashtag Friday Report, or you can text IW a space in your message. Send it in to 81222 and just let me know your thoughts on that. From 5p on plastic bags to another shock headline about the Isle of Wight. Liam, coming back to you for this one. The Isle of Wight was this week in one of the papers named the welfare capital of the country, which when you actually read a little bit further wasn't quite all it seemed. Just tell me a little bit about this story and what your reaction to seeing that was.
I think, to be honest, it's not the best way to portray this is where the statistics thing doesn't work, because what it didn't take into account when it looks at the welfare calculations, it includes people's pensions, and to be honest, people's pensions are things they've contributed towards over the years, so it's not really a welfare benefits kind of payment, and you take that away from it and we're nowhere near the top. So I think it's a rubbish story, if I'm honest. I think it's very misleading. Yes, on the Isle of Wight we have our own issues, and our fairly unique geographical location and our unique demographic gives us specific issues to the island, but let's not add to it by writing those kind of stories which sensationalise something that's just not true.
However, it does have a bit of a knock-on effect. Presumably, Nigel, it's very telling in the hospice sector, because if the Isle of Wight is top of that list when you include pensions, that obviously paints a picture of the type of person living on the Isle of Wight, and presumably that has a knock-on effect for you.
Yeah, and you know, we have an older population, and it's the tsunami that's coming towards us, and our whole care systems, both health and social care, we need to do something radical in order to make those work a lot better. And you know, we can talk more about that, but in terms of, you know, as Lee said, these sensational headlines that now is out there in the British psyche, that will go on and people will remember it, because it's a short media burst. It says the Isle of Wight is the capital, you know, the benefits capital of the UK. I've had people ring me up sort of saying, oh, you know, I hear you're the benefits capital of the UK. I mean, that's not true to start with, and we have to get the right story out there.
Stuart, your thoughts on this? I mean, what was your feeling when you saw it, and what can be done in terms of, because when it comes down to it, this is a report, this is statistics based on an actual report. So why is there a report that sort of will say the Isle of Wight's the benefits capital? By the way, it includes pensions. Why are those two put together?
Well, we can always rely on the good old Daily Mail, can't we, Lucy, to get these things into the public domain really use that for their own agenda. And let's not beat about the bush here. The Daily Mail was using it for their own particular agenda, which is not the real story here, as Lee and Nigel have both said. The real story here is that people have contributed all their lives towards these pensions and they're entitled to that money. You take away that, you extrapolate that money out of the equation, and we come down to a more realistic level of the benefit levels on the Isle of Wight. But, you know, it worries me about the future when Ian Duncan Smith's universal credit kicks in and tax credits kick in towards the end of the year, just before Christmas actually this year. You know, it's going to hit home to people how serious this problem is, and people who are on welfare are really, really hurting at the end of the day. And it ill behoves people like the Daily Mail and newspapers like that to try and tar the Isle of Wight with this brush, and people in power in the Isle of Wight should really be putting forward very forcibly the other side of the story.
Lee, do you want to come back on that in terms of those cuts at the end of the year and the impact that's likely to have?
Yeah, I think, you know, we work actually very closely with a lot of other organisations that give advice and information, along with organisations that may be affected by those changes, particularly around universal credit at the minute, because that's a very new thing. You know, the biggest worry with universal credit is the way the money is given to people. So at the minute, if you're in social housing, the money that you're given for social housing goes straight to the social landlord. When universal credit comes in, that's not the case. The money is paid to the individual that's in social housing. It's their responsibility then to pay their landlord, and actually that could cause all sorts of problems. And, you know, that's people that may not necessarily have the skills, that's people that may never have had that much money in their bank account before, that's people that may have other priorities to use that money on, that have suddenly got it and maybe need a new school uniform for their kids, maybe need to put food on the table. They've now got that money, and that could then have not only a serious knock-on effect for them personally, but the social housing organisations could have a serious cash flow implication. That means then they can't pay for the renovations that need doing on their houses. The impact of universal credit and the way it's been portrayed actually is huge. And we're working hard on the island to educate and to help train organisations to help them understand what's happening, so that they can then inform the people that come through their door with questions.
Is that a bit patronising, though, in terms of the people that are going to get the money? You know, that's a bit distrustful, saying, you know, are you going to be able to spend this properly? People are grown adults. Yeah,
I think it's a fact of life, Lucy. When you, if you're, for example, coming up to Christmas and you've got a young family, and the system changes to the effect that a cheque for maybe £1,000 or £1,500 dropped through your mailbox rather than goes to pay your rent, and your children are screaming at you that they want a, whatever it is, a PlayStation or a computer or something like that. The pressure on you is enormous, but the peer pressure from these children's friends who maybe come from families with money and already have these things. So the pressure is going to be on these families, and it's going to be a horrendous situation that they find themselves in. And to just pick up what Lee said there, there's going to be a double whammy here. Not only are the housing associations going to suffer from the cash flow, and I've spoken to housing associations about this, people like the Southern Housing Group are talking, you know, in the tens of millions of pounds that they could, in the end, feasibly lose out on. But then there's a double whammy of being forced to sell social housing from within their groups. So there's going to be a huge pressure on housing, there's going to be a huge pressure on families, added to, as I said before, the tax credit cuts coming along. It seems to me that there's a great explosion waiting to happen here.
And Nigel, in terms of end-of-life care here, I mean, what we, you know, we have this image of young families who are maybe getting these universal credits, but of course all ages can be affected by this. And people heading towards pension age, there's been the big change in terms of being able to access your pension money and so on. Are you, in the hospice sector, are you worried about the knock-on effects here? Are people going to be able to start paying for things like care and hospice care and contribute toward costs at the end of their lives?
I mean, I think that this whole problem's across the system, isn't it? Because where it sent me thinking was around personal health budgets and how they're developing and people getting access to those. And it's helping people, I suppose, understand. And Lee was talking about training and how we educate people into these new systems of how we can help them spend the money in the right way for themselves. And Stuart's absolutely right. The pressure of having to spend it in certain ways from all kinds of directions is what people are under. And we need to help them, saying, actually, we need to help you spend this money in the right way for yourself at this current time. And there is an issue, I think, across the whole of the UK. Our systems just don't join up. So someone makes a decision about one system that has a knock-on effect all the way down the line, and no one's thought about that. And that's just absolutely crazy. And until we can talk to each other about these things before making decisions, that's, you know, nothing's going to change.
So who's in charge of making that happen? Because here you are, three of you in different sectors, all at different ends of this particular problem. Who's in charge of making sure that everyone does sit down and talk?
We all are. I think that's what it comes down to. I think anybody that represents a community has a responsibility to ensure that the community are well enough represented and have enough resources to be able to properly budget to actually apply for universal credit, because the change in the application process is quite significant. It goes from being able to walk into somewhere and speak to someone to being completely online. It's a huge change. You need some IT training. We need some training to understand what it means. You need a computer, and we're working hard, actually, all the agencies, including the DWP, the local authority, social housing groups, a lot of people that are involved in the anti-poverty group that we belong to. We're looking at ways to help people have a smoother process through this. There's now more portals in libraries. There's a universal portal that's starting to be rolled out across the island that we're trialling in several locations. So you could be an individual that's in Freshwater. You might not be able to make it in, but you know that whatever system you use will look, feel and act the same. So it's having that consistency of advice and information, that consistency of the operating system that people can use to apply for around the island, and that should hopefully help with people's confidence to use it, but it won't solve the problem.
All right. Again, if you're... Oh, sorry, Stuart, there we go.
I was just going to add to what Lee said there, that it's very important, this education and taking people along with you. And the CAB, in fact, visits Ventnor now at the Green Room at Salisbury Gardens, the new headquarters of Ventnor Town Council, and the police on the South Wight, by the way. And I think that can only be a good thing. And if that was rolled out through the other towns and villages in the Isle of Wight, it would be a great boost to people. It's very expensive for somebody to travel, for example, from Ventnor to Newport. I mean, it's £4.50 each way. And if you're on benefits, that's a hell of a lot of money to try and find. So it helps. And it's all credit to the CEAB for coming to Ventnor and allowing people just to walk up to their office and get the advice that they need.
Is this affecting you? Again, do let me know today. I have had a text on our other subject this afternoon. Hi, Lucy, says Ted in God's Hill. On a lighter note, with the 5p bag charge, it now makes the cupboard under my sink worth £642.65. No bin bags for you anytime soon.
Get rummaging.
Did I also see on Facebook that people were selling plastic bags for 3p each?
Yeah, sure.
Goodness me. Anyway, from that on to the Isle of Wight's been in yet another survey, Nigel, this week. Tell me about it's a bit difficult to sort of compare the two, but the Isle of Wight's been called the best place to die.
The UK has been called the best place to die.
So tell me a little bit about that and how it impacts the island.
Yeah, it's really sort of wound me up, actually, so you'll get me onto my hobby horse at the moment. But, you know, the Economist Intelligence Unit published this report 5 years ago. The UK came top then. It came top the second time they've done it. We have a really good system for end of life in the UK, and that's actually based around hospice care. The issue is that too many people in the UK don't get access to it. So my worry is we now again have this message that the UK is the best place to die. Aren't we wonderful? Let's all sit back. There's so much more work to be done that actually it's really, really important that we don't just sit back and let it happen. So, you know, for instance, hospices, it's 500,000 deaths in the UK a year. Hospices get in touch with support 7 to 10% of those people.
And is that reflected on the Isle of Wight? Is that
it's
the
reflected
here?
Across the whole UK. So, you know, there are some real problems on the Isle of Wight that people are not getting access to our care, to other comparable care when they should be. And that's a whole problem in the system. Again, it depends what disease you've got. It depends how you're dying. You know, people are dying slower because they're actually living longer. So the care needs to go in earlier. This is a real problem. And if we don't get our act together, we're going to end up in a real mess. One of the key issues, just talking about how we're all going to make this work together, is the two big systems, the local authority, social services and health, actually don't work together. So getting people out of hospital, for instance, a person in hospital this week, the actual social care, the personal care at home, is delivered by private agencies that the LA, the local authority, actually sort of contract out to. We're saying we need to get this person home today. The care agency is saying, actually, we can't put a care package in for 6 weeks. It's like, well, that's not okay. So we need to actually find a way of joining up the health and social care system.
And yet, is the money there? I mean, it's difficult to argue that the money that is there shouldn't be thrown at acute services, mm-hmm. immediate care, mm-hmm. A&E, mm-hmm. And keeping that going to the best of its ability.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things around the UK, and they say that one of the things around why it's the best place to die, is that we give people choice. The reality is people don't have a choice. What we have to make sure is good care is going to happen in whatever bed you die in, whether that's in the hospital, at the hospice, in the home, in a care home, wherever that is, you should be entitled to absolutely the highest quality care. And I think when people get to the end of life, whether that's the last year, the last 2 years of life, the hospice needs to take some kind of lead on that, because we have the expertise to do it. And whether it's a lead in providing the care or educating other people on the best way of providing that kind of care, we need to be involved in it. The problem is the system at the moment doesn't allow us to do that.
Do politicians do enough for you? Can they be doing more? Can they be sort of taking on that message and doing something?
Everyone across the country loves their local hospice. I mean, people have a love affair with them. The problem is people sort of stand back from them and don't really understand what it is they do. So on any one day, we look after 600 people at home. I mean, the building in Newport is the tip of the iceberg, but everyone thinks that's where it all happens. I mean, the building's really important. We have the beds there where we can help, and we have the John Cheverton Centre and various other services. But our staff and our money is going out there for people at home. And if the personal care bit, if the care is coming in on a day-to-day basis and we don't get that right, it makes the system just completely fall apart. Mm-hmm. And again, for instance, this week I was hearing a story from someone from a local care agency where the carer, and this is not the carer's fault, they paid very little money and they're told to actually get in and out the house as quickly as possible. So this carer had been told, she was going in, she's had to feed someone, she had to help someone eat, because they couldn't do that for themselves. And she was told by the agency, don't talk to the person, because if you get into a conversation, they'll actually keep you there longer. Now, that, they're the stories that are coming back at us. The system's completely wrong.
That's horrifying.
Yeah, it is horrifying. And that is just one story in a mix of hundreds and hundreds of stories across this island on any one day. It's absolutely horrifying, and we need to do something about it.
So what's being done? Is there, are there enough whistleblowers? I mean, you know, are we not hearing the name of the agency?
Well, I mean, the advocacy, people who do advocacy are the people who are taking this forward, and actually they're the ones who are there hearing these stories from people. We just need to take the story and, you know, make sure the right people hear them in the right place, so that the care is being given by the right agencies at the right time. We believe the end of life, we should do social care as well as healthcare. We're the experts in doing it. Or we should be training social carers to do it. The problem is the system doesn't allow us to do that at the moment.
And I mean, Lee, again, in terms of the people that come into you, I mean, do you have that tie up with end of life care and hospice care? Are you able to advise people on that?
Yeah, we actually have a specific Macmillan caseworker who deals with welfare and benefits around people that have been diagnosed potentially with terminal illnesses. So we do have a link with the hospice. I think we are working, Nigel, if I'm right in saying, to have better links and to communicate better. And I think that there's always ways to do things better and always better communication. We're always looking and working on that, working better in partnership together. But we do what we do at the minute really well, but we're always looking to improve that. So your answer is yes, we do, but we're always looking to get better at that.
The good work that Lee's organisation does is really important for people when they're diagnosed with a terminal illness. So you have the shock, you have the pressure of having to go through treatment, of realising that hasn't quite worked, and then you have a raft of forms that you have to fill in order to get the money you're entitled to. We need to be able to help people with that, and Lee's work doing more of that with him is really important.
I have to say at this point it's not really a pitch, but that particular funding stream that we have to help people not have to worry about money while they're going through this treatment is coming to an end, and we don't know if we're going to find any more funding for it. And it's a really important thing that happens. You know, we're not precious who takes that on, but it's really important that continues.
Who funds it at the moment, and who are you using?
At the moment, Macmillan do, but their model is very much that they start things and that they then look for those to become sustainable if at all possible, so they reduce their funding. And we've managed to get some more funding until April next year, and we're trying really hard to make sure that funding keeps extending, but it's a constant battle. And actually, for something like that, it shouldn't be a battle. That money should just be, there you go, it's really important.
And that's the problem with organisations like ours, is people come along with a pump prime to set something up, which is really important. And of course, you're going to say yes, because you know how important it is. But sustaining it beyond the funding, it becomes more and more complex.
Okay, maybe you're affected by this issue and you want to have a say today. Do text me, IW, a space in your message. Send it into 81222. Another text here. As we suspected, the 5p plastic bags are the ones causing the stories today. This is A on Twitter. I lived in Germany 20 years ago. I caused a commotion at the supermarket checkout there because I didn't have my own bags. The UK is way behind. But catching up quickly, I suspect. Let's take a break then. When we come back, we're going to talk about an incident that happened at the Conservative Party conference this week, involving one of our local councillors.
This is the Friday Report.
Landlords, Are your tenants safe from carbon monoxide?
Tenants, has your landlord protected you from fire risk?
Government legislation is expected this autumn to make it compulsory for landlords to fit fire and carbon monoxide alarms. White Fire and Security are available to professionally install these lifesavers.
But please, don't wait. Act now. Contact White Fire and Security. It could save someone's life.
Visit whitefire.co.uk for all your safety needs.
Just imagine. Stunning sunsets from a great beachside setting. Freshly caught fish and fabulous Mediterranean-inspired dishes. You'll find all this and more at the new look Waterfront Restaurant in Totland. Under new management, the Waterfront now offers a wide range of delicious dining. Hop in for a cup of tea and a snack in the garden, or linger for longer with a superb main meal. Call the Waterfront Restaurant on 756 969 for a warm welcome, amazing views and wonderful food.
The BMW i3. It's not just an electric car. It's an electric car that drives like a BMW. Rentals from £299 per month. Discover more at bmw.co.uk/i3. £3,699 initial rental. 36-month hire agreement from BMW Financial Services. Subject to status and availability for new vehicles ordered before 31st of December 2015 and registered by 31st of March 2016. UK only, guarantees may be required. Mileage and other conditions apply when you return the vehicle.
At Carpet Right, there's 50% off a choice of floors and beds and interest-free credit. Many offers end Tuesday, 8 p.m. at Carpet Right. Representative 0% APR, 10% deposit minimum spend applies.
As darkness falls, enjoy a stunning spectacle of light, colour and sound as Robin Hill's Electric Woods presents the Festival of Light. Light, light.
Every evening throughout October, experience the lush colours, flavours and magic of India. Wander through the Electric Woods and be entertained by a Diwali-inspired sound and light show and shadow theatre. Savour authentic Indian food and take part in colour quest battles with live music and special performances every Saturday night. To find out more and buy tickets online, visit electricwoods.co.uk.
The law is changing. From the 1st of October 2015, it is illegal to smoke in vehicles with someone under 18 present. With one less place to smoke, there's one more reason to quit. Sign up to Stoptober for free support. Laws apply in England and Wales. Stoptober takes place across England.
The Italian Touch. Our autumn-winter collections are now arriving.
Proud sponsors of Mid-Mornings on Isle of Wight Radio. This is the Friday Report.
Welcome back to the Friday Report here in the studio. They're Nigel Hartley, who's the CEO of the Earl Mountbatten Hospice, Stuart Blackmore from the Isle of Wight Labour Party, and from Isle of Wight CAB, Lee Hodgson, who's the CEO there. Joining me, I'm Lucy, and this is the Friday Report. Now, we've talked a number of issues, but another one making the news this week was the Conservative Party conference attended by the Isle of Wight MP and also Isle of Wight Councillor Ian Ward, who was on this show last week, telling us how much he was looking forward to it. A great chance, he said, to get hold of the ministers who are making the decisions and really have a say on policy. Anyway, as the conference got underway, we were hearing stories that that there were safety concerns with the Conservative Party members who were attending. We heard reports that they weren't allowed to wear their lanyards out and about because of fears over their safety. And then this happened. Ian Ward was punched, he said. He said he was at the Conservative Party conference. He was accosted outside the hall by a scruffy demonstrator who called me Tory scum. Mark Chiverton has been outspoken this week in terms of that description of the person who assaulted Ian there. A scruffy demonstrator. Stuart, let's come to you on this. Now, there were there were many protests going on there. Let me get your reaction to that description of what was going on outside. There has been a suggestion that is a very generic way to describe what was going on outside the Tory Party conference.
Yeah, a scruffy demonstrator. I mean, it depends on how you describe people and how you would describe them as scruffy or not. I don't know. There were tens of thousands of people, I believe, demonstrating outside the Conservative Party conference, and it was in exactly the same place as the Labour Party conference was in Manchester last year at the conference centre. And the security, I have to say, was unbelievable. It was anybody who's been through Edinburgh Airport, which I thought had the best security in the world at one point, need have no worries about the security there. So I don't know about the individual incident, although you know, it can't be condoned if Ian was assaulted in the way that he describes. But you have to be very careful in politics when you describe other people, because you leave yourself open to people coming back at you with the descriptions that you use. So although I never saw it myself, I don't think there was any pictures taken of it, so we have to take Ian's word, and Ian being a gentleman, we take his word as being true. That, but Scruffy, I don't think my cats used to be scruffy. I wouldn't describe necessarily another human being as being scruffy. The person who did it is a human being and probably had a reason for being there. And maybe people like Ian should listen to the reasons why people are taking the actions that they are taking. They have numerous grievances, and Ian is a part of the government, and not a part of the government. He's a member of the party in government at the moment, which is having a huge dilatory effect on people's lives, and people should be listened to. Maybe Ian should start listening to the reasons why people decide that they have to take to the streets and take the actions that they do take.
Is it fair that there are all these people outside protesting at the Conservative Party conference when we didn't hear similar stories, especially not in terms of concerns for safety at the other party conferences?
I was at the Labour Party conference in Brighton this year, and there were no instances of any kind of mass demonstration, obviously because Labour is not the party of government, the Conservatives are the party of government, so there is a reason why people are demonstrating. But I have to emphasise, Lucy, that the police are there in their thousands at these. Ever since the hugely unfortunate incident of the Brighton bomb all those years ago, which the Thatcher government was involved, I mean, it's very, very difficult to get near anybody at one of the conferences. It really is. And anybody who's, for example, at ministerial cabinet level are surrounded by their own personal security people, it is very difficult. And obviously, there's a lot of hustle and bustle going around, and the person that had this fracas with Ian probably didn't know who Ian was. He never had his lanyard on, probably never knew. How would they know that he was a Tory to call him a Tory scum? There would be no way of identifying him to see whether... Certainly when I was at the Labour Party conference, we wore our identification badges wherever we went, because we weren't even allowed into the hotels without them. So it was impossible to...
Given the size of the security that has to happen now, are they justified, these party conferences? We were talking about it last week, that they were a very positive thing, a chance to shape policy. But, you know, NASA made an announcement that to potentially found life on Mars, and they did that via Skype, via a stream, worldwide. Are these huge events where so much security is required, are they justified?
Well, there is an argument for that. I mean, the whole object of these things is to send the troops away with a smile on their face and make them feel good about themselves.
But you can send everyone a free cake, can't you? And everyone's happy.
I was just thinking while you were saying that, Lucy, that I take back what I said about the security of the Conservative Party conference, because Jeremy Corbyn was able to attend a fringe event without any trouble there. So if he was allowed in, there must have been something wrong with
him. He wasn't wearing his tweed jacket, was he?
He wasn't. He might have been, but I don't think he was wearing a Conservative lanyard.
Okay, all right.
Maybe he's wearing his Boy Scout lanyard, I don't know.
Stuart, while we're talking, let's touch on another story that you've been commenting on this week in your other guise as part of KILF. Now, this is the Future of Ireland line. It's the South West Trains contract will end shortly, and a successor is required. The Future of Ireland line within that contract is currently up for discussion. Mm. We've been hearing this week a letter that was released on an FOI, Freedom of Information request, that found that in March, Andrew Turner was requesting a response from the Rail Minister to get her to confirm that a committee was being put together. And the quote is along the lines of, to ensure that it's handed over to a community enterprise company. Just give me your thoughts on this particular story.
Well, this story's taken an unbelievable turn, Lucy. It's you'll probably remember I was in the studio with... and Nicholas Finney a few weeks ago talking about, and David Pugh, who I should declare an interest, we are part of KELF together. But it was completely denied at the time. And I challenged Andrew Turner a number of times during the election campaign when I was standing as a Labour Party candidate in Elawite about this thing. And at every turn, they said there was absolutely no intention to hand the Isle of Wight Railway over to a public interest company, or CIC, whichever you would like to call it. And as you know, Kilf is insistent that it should be kept within the franchise. And here we have in black and white this one or two paragraph letter signed by Andrew Turner 3 days before the polls opened, imploring Claire Perry to come out in public and say that she would hand over the Isle of Wight to a community interest company. Now, somebody has got some explaining to do, not least Andrew Turner and certainly Nicholas Finnear, about how that letter came to be there. There was no mention of it. If it hadn't been for Kilf insisting on seeing this letter through Freedom of Information, nobody would have been any the wiser. Now, this is at the very, very least disingenuous, at the very least.
Now, he wasn't asking to come out in public and say it necessarily, but he wanted written confirmation, didn't he? So that entering
Well, he was saying things in private, obviously, that he wasn't prepared to say in public. And that still, to me, is disingenuous. You could go as far as to say that it's dishonest. If you're having a public campaign about something, you're entitled to be honest to the public about what you want to happen to something at the end of the day. What they want to happen to the Island Line is that it's privatised further than it even is now, becomes part of a community interest company. And they really, if that is the case, then why don't they come out and say it?
Let's put this in simple terms, just to find out where we are now on this. In terms of where I would sit as a passenger, say, I just want to know there's going to be a train. I want to make sure I can get from A to B, and the intricacies of how that's achieved. You know, do I need to be worrying about that? Where are we now, and how much do I need to be genuinely concerned?
Well, I think a fair paying passenger has to be worried about it, because the consultation is just about to start. But if this is the way the government is actually thinking about moving things along, I think you're entitled to be worried. My worry is that if Island Line is cut adrift from the franchise, then A, where is the funding going to come from? And B, what will happen if, as will happen, the funding runs out? That is what the travelling public have to be worried about. And that is where we need some concrete answers. We need, you know, straightforward concrete answers about that.
All right. And I should say that we have requested a response from Andrew Turner's office, but we have heard nothing this week so far. I want to talk Hospice Care Week, Nigel, because I believe we're at the end of Hospice Care Week now, aren't we? Just tell me about that. Yeah. What does it mean?
We are. This is an annual event which has been going on for a number of years now, first week in October. An opportunity for us to highlight the work that hospices do across the UK. Again, it's a bit about what I was talking earlier, that people have a lot of misconceptions about what hospices are and what they do. So it's about both celebrating what we do, but also, I suppose, informing the public and trying to get people to see the reality of who we are and what we do. So, you know, one of the key things for us has been about getting people in the building. We've talked about this on the radio a number of times, you know, opening the concert series, getting people used to coming to the hospice and seeing that dying actually in many circumstances is quite normal. And it can be managed. And that's a really good message for people to have from within living, if that makes sense. So people are not coming in shock and not coming in panic. They're coming when they don't really need to, and they're getting a message by seeing what goes on there very realistically and seeing that this building actually is a place to come, create good memories, have a good time together and see some really good care.
And along those lines, before we move too far away from Bestival, the Kissy Puppy campaign was very evident during Bestival. Yeah. But what people maybe didn't realise was that some of the volunteers who were out and about with Kissy Puppy were actually hospice volunteers under the Kissy Puppy banner. Tell me a little bit about how you're working together.
Well, the majority of money the Kissy Puppy raise actually comes to hospice services for children. So we look after children who die and give aftercare at the hospice. So in the last 6 weeks, we've had 2 young children in at the hospice. Supporting their families. So a very important part of who we are. One of the great things about Kissy Puppy is they're now going to help us fund a new children's bereavement service that we're going to develop over the next year. It's a very important partnership with us, and it's really driven by, you know, Aaron and Gemma Roth, who came from a very personal experience, and that's how these things start. So we work very closely. Best of all, we focus on Kissy Puppy. The Isle of Wight Festival is more the hospice.